Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Well, dear Blood River Radio family, finally we got some reinforcements here, man, to take over from the discombobulated bombardier. I'd like to apologize again for my temper. My temper got away from me. It gets away from me so bad, and I guarantee it ain't fake. I'm one of these people, when I get mad, I can't think. Yes, I need to try to stay calmer. But anyway, we got cooler heads in here. We got the bitter ender himself in here. We got Sister Nancy. Sister Nancy's got some stuff she's going to tell us about. I think she's going to tell us about some badges that she sent me and that we're going to start maybe trying to manufacture. And as you know, we started our degree course last week with the Bitter Ender talking about, different things, all things Confederacy and white. So we're going to start that course tonight. And just to remind you, if you listen to all – well, there's actually going to be five lessons because we're going to do it every week, every Saturday in March. We did 1 week last week. We'll get you a degree, and we're going to send you a Confederate flag. For all people that pass, you have to pass now. You have to submit an essay, and the professor and the assistant professor, Nancy, if they grade it, if they think it's meritorious and you make it 80 or better, then we'll give you a bachelor's degree. If you make it probably 95 or so, we'll – that's probably put you in doctorate level. Anyway, with that, we're going back to my big sister Nancy Hitt. And before we do that, we also want the Bitter Ender to say hello to our audience out there, our family out there. Hey, Bitter Ender, go ahead.
Well, great. Yes, glad everybody's tuned in. We have some Confederate history for you that occurred during the month of March, and we'll tell you about our Confederate flag ceremony we had at the Forest Home this afternoon. So, ready to go.
I hear that myself. Well, that sounds like great. I'm ready to relax a little bit, and I'm going to enjoy the history of my lesson myself. I don't feel smart enough to send the essay in, though, so yeah, I may have to get William honorary things. Like, for the
guy I never got an 85 in a class. I shouldn't be grading this.
Well, that leaves me out, too. Maybe Big Sister could do the grading.
She could do that with a red pencil mark on it.
Yes, sir. Mine would be all red. Well, Sister, Big Sister Nancy, take us away.
Yes, we want to do a tar and feathering every week, and so this week it's going to be dedicated to the Jews at the Southern Poverty Law Center. They deserve a tar and feathering, a lot of hot tar, and a lot of white feathers. And then I also want to present some tar and feathers to three Jews who were involved in O'Kane, this war crime of destroying the Nord Stream 1 and 2, which connects Russia to Germany. These are all Jews: Victoria Nuland, Jake Sullivan, and Anthony Blinken. I'm unsure about William Burns. He's the head of the CIA. I couldn't prove that he was a Jew. Then we've got this anti-white President Biden. And unfortunately, I have a lot of questions about this new German chancellor, Olaf Scholz. I have a feeling he collaborated secretly on allowing the destruction of these two very important and very expensive pipelines into Germany. So we'll wait on the tar and feathering for the German chancellor, but we'll tar and feather President, anti-white President Biden. And I wanted to mention that I heard recently that the Black Shirts, which were a fascist organization under Oswald Mosley in England, have risen up again, and there is a movement in the UK to reinvigorate the Black Shirt movement of fascism again in UK in England. So those were actually that's about. I'm going to leave it to our professor, Gene, to give us some lessons on Confederate history.
Oh, well, thank you, and thank you for the information there. It's amazing how this chicanery that these governments pull off eventually comes to the surface, and they think they can keep it hidden. But the United States and Biden bragging about he's going to take out the Nord Stream pipeline, and then lo and behold, it happens. And then he claims that he didn't know anything about it. Does he really think the American people are as stupid as he is? I mean, come on, give us a break. Anyway, put those idiots behind us. We want to talk a little bit about some of our Confederate history that occurred in the month of March. Now, we had mentioned this last week, but on March the 6th, the Confederate First National Flag was presented by the Flag Committee and the Confederate Congress in Montgomery, Alabama. And so March 6th is considered Confederate Flag Day. Well, I think it's the 14th is the U.S. Flag Day in this country, or their country, excuse me. But March the 6th, 1861, was when the first national flag, and we talked about the first national flag being the flag with the blue canton in the corner and then the red, white, and red stripe and the circle of stars. And you could always tell, and that flag was nicknamed the Stars and Bars because it had the stars in the circle and the bars of the red, white, and red stripe. And the idea was they wanted it to look like the first Revolutionary War flag because the people on the flag committee said, if the Yankees don't leave us in peace, we'll have to fight the Second War of Independence, this time not against King George III of England, but against King Abraham I of the United States. So that's why they came up with that design. And like I said, it was nicknamed the Stars and Bars. And you can always tell the news nerds that don't know anything about our history because they always put up a picture of the battle flag, which has the diagonal St. Andrew's cross or the Celtic cross on it. And they refer to that as the Stars and Bars. And they go, oh, controversy over the Stars and Bars. Details at 6 on Channel 2. And you know they don't know what they're talking about. They just rattle off whatever they put up in front of them to read it off. And they always reinforce their stupidity. But anyway, that's where the flag came from, and that's where the nickname came from. But we have always the first Saturday in March, we have a Confederate flag ceremony at the N.B. Forrest home down at Chapel Hill, Tennessee. Had a great one today. The weather was just perfect. We had some horrible wind and storms, and there were three or four people that were killed in Tennessee from having trees falling on them yesterday. And a lot of damage and a lot of power was out, and our power was out about 5 hours. And there are they said about 26,000 people in Middle Tennessee that still don't have power from all the trees coming over on the power lines. But anyway, it was great today, and we have a program that talks about the Confederate flags, and then at the end of the program, they take any of the flags that are worn out, misused, and faded, and have a very solemn program where the flags are burned, and that's how you're supposed to get rid of an old flag, not just toss it away in the garbage. And then after that, we had somebody playing taps, and it was a very excellent program that they had out there, and I hope we're going to continue that every year. This is about the third year we've had it at the Forrest Home, and the crowd keeps getting bigger and bigger every year. So really enjoy having that piece of Confederate history brought to life and information about our flags. The other event that I thought we might cover was an event that happened about a year later on March the 6th, 1862, when the Confederate ironclad, the CSS Virginia, that was built in the naval yard at Norfolk. Now, when the Yankees abandoned Norfolk, the Navy Yard there, they destroyed as much of the naval equipment as they could, and there was a frigate there in dry dock, the USS Merrimack, and they burned the ship, and it burned down to the waterline, and of course, when it hit the waterline, the fire went out. So when the Confederates came in and took over Norfolk, they raised it up and got the water out of it where it had sunk into the part of the dry dock there or the harbor area there and cleaned it up. And then they built a metal casement over the top of it with slanted sides. And they even figured this out. They did tests, and they decided that 36 degrees was the best angle to deflect artillery shells or cannonballs that were coming into a warship. And this was one of the first ironclad warships that had been built, at least in North America. The French and the British had been experimenting with this. And the U.S. government didn't want to have anything to do with it. The old traditionalist Navy admirals and so forth said, oh, no, you will never defeat a naval warship, a sail ship. And although they had steam engines, they still had the sails, and they were wooden hulls. And they thought that if they put enough cannons on there, it could defeat anything. But when you're firing two cannonballs or 200 cannonballs, if it's hitting an iron plating and bouncing off at an angle, it's not doing much good. So on March the 8th, the newly christened CSS Virginia steamed out of the harbor at Norfolk, out into Hampton Roads, that water area there, the southern end of the Chesapeake Bay, and it went after the federal blockading ships that were there, the fleet there. It rammed the USS Cumberland, one of these frigates that could take on anything in the world, rammed the Cumberland, and it sank. It came in and fired at the Congress at close range, set it on fire. It burned and sank. And the USS Minnesota took one look at this thing that looked like a raft floating out across the water, and it took off and tried to get out of there and ran aground. But by that time, the tide was running out, and the Virginia couldn't go into shallow water either, so it had to turn around and go back into port there in Norfolk. Then and that night, there was something that came by. They saw it in the light of the burning Congress. They couldn't really figure out what it was. But the next morning on March the 9th, when Virginia came out to finish off the Minnesota or any other federal ships in the blockade, they saw this thing that looked like a raft in the water, just a flat raft floating around with a round turret on it, which was the USS Monitor, the answer to the Virginia, the ironclad. And for years and years, like we said, the naval traditionists didn't want to have anything to do with iron ships. But when the spies in Norfolk told them that, well, these Confederates are building an ironclad something down there, they finally got on the stick. And John Ericsson, a Swiss inventor, had come up with the plans for this, and they finally gave him the go-ahead to build this ship. And we'll finish that up after our break.
Thank you so much, Gene. Hey, folks, we'll be right back.
Have you ever heard of Loving Liberty Ladies? Well, the Loving Liberty Ladies are here to help you learn our American heritage and the way it affects today's society. The Loving Liberty Ladies also have a discussion guide called Proclaim Liberty. And with this guide, you can start your own group in your hometown. Get yours today on our website at lovingliberty.net. Look for our lesson supplements, too. They're free. To hear all the special offers and to join the fight for freedom and liberty, please go to lovingliberty.net.
I'm Michael Hill, President of the League of the South. I and my compatriots are Southern Nationalists. We seek the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people, our people. The League wants a South that enjoys the sweet fruits of Christian liberty and prosperity, but our current situation won't allow it. We must have our independence from Washington, D.C., and the globalists. The present system cannot be reformed. Without independence, we will continue down this path of destruction. To us, this is not acceptable. I'm asking you, Southern man and woman, to join us today to free the South. Call us at 256-757-6789 or see our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. God save the South.
The spirit of the American West is alive and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues of the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas like this year's Buckaroo calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach.
Oh, dear Blood River Radio audience, just a hint, just a little hint out there. Some of the stuff we said last week about things that are going to be might pop up on the test. We barely missed this Linus Carl Pauling. Born February the 28th of 1901, died August in 1994. One of the, he's been named more like one of the 20 greatest scientists the world's ever seen. I tell you what, if you can, we might ask him something about him on the some of these questions, these test questions. Just as a hint, he one of his greatest, most controversial statements, papers he wrote, had to do with a certain nutrient. If you write in your essay about Confederate history, White History Week, just as a little note, you might, if you say something about Linus Pauling and what his most controversial paper was written on, he was responsible for probably over 100 inventions. That's why he got the Nobel Prize for the first time in 1954. Well, shut up. We're going to go right back to Professor Gene. Then after he gets through, we're going to go to Miss Nancy. But go ahead, Gene. Carry on, brother.
Well, we were talking about the Confederate ironclad, the CSS Virginia, and the Confederates weren't stupid people. They knew they didn't have a Navy large enough to offset the Federal Navy. So what they had better do is come up with some type of new invention that could take on the Federal fleet and neutralize the numbers of the Federal fleet. And Stephen Mallory was Secretary of the Navy, and he wasn't bogged down with all the old Navy traditions and everything. He thought, he'd been reading about and hearing about these ironclad ships that the British and the French were building. And he as he served, he was a senator in the United States Congress, and as he was on the Naval Affairs Committee, and he was trying to get the Navy to build ironclad ships, and he said, in the next war, this is what we're going to have to fight. And the traditionalists in the Navy just, you know, poo-pooed that idea and turned that down and said, no, the wooden sailing ships are what we need. And they never did. So when Jefferson Davis asked him, he knew that they'd been in the Senate together, and he knew Stephen Mallory, from the senator from Florida. And so when he asked him to serve as the chairman of the Naval Department and serve on the cabinet, then he had no tradition. So he could build anything that he wanted. He could build ironclad ships. If he could figure out to build flying saucers, he would have built those because there was no tradition. And so that's why they came up with all these ironclad ships. And an interesting thing about it, I did some research on it. The Confederates built about 24 of them at different times during the war in all the port cities, Savannah, Charleston, Norfolk. The ones they had on the dock in New Orleans had to be destroyed when Farragut's fleet came up the Mississippi River. But Mobile, all of these port cities were building these, and there was, and during the course of the war and all the naval battles that were fought, only one of the Confederate ironclads was defeated by the United States Navy. And that, unfortunately, was the poor old CSS Tennessee in the Battle of Mobile Bay. And it took on 19 Federal warships in that battle at Mobile Bay. And finally, they just shot the anchor chain off of it, and it was dead in the water. They couldn't turn it, and they just kept circling it like Indians circling a wagon train, just finally beat it to pieces till it finally surrendered. But the rest of them that were taken out of action, unfortunately, had to be blown up by the Confederates, because the Federal Navy couldn't defeat them, but as a land army closed in behind them, like Sherman's army coming into to Charleston or Savannah or wherever, they would have to pack the ship full of gunpowder, set it on fire, and blow it up to keep it from falling into the hands of the enemy. But that was further on down the road. We're back at on March the 9th in 1862 at Chesapeake Bay. So the Virginia had gone out, taken care of the Cumberland, the Congress, run the Minnesota aground, was going to go back and finish them off the next day. And when they came out, there was a strange-looking ship with the deck laying down almost at the waterline and a round turret on it was the USS Monitor that they'd finally gotten built and sailed down to Virginia after they found out that the Confederates were building an ironclad ship. So both ships went after each other out there in Chesapeake Bay. And the Virginia tried to ram the Monitor, and the Monitor kept firing at the Virginia. Of course, its shells were just bouncing off, and they circled each other. It was about a six-hour battle out there. Damn. And the commander of the Confederate ship, the Virginia, Franklin Buchanan, was wounded. And he was wounded the day before because when the Cumberland, or the, yes, the Cumberland was sinking, the Federal sailors were jumping off the ship and out into the water. He brought the Virginia over to try to rescue some of the Federal sailors that were in the water drowning. And back then, not everybody knew how to swim like today. As soon as you're old enough, they take you to the Y and teach you how to swim. But back then, very, very few people knew how to swim, even people in the Navy, which meant you know, when your ship went down, if you couldn't get in a lifeboat, you're going down with it. So he was trying to pick up the federal naval personnel in the water, because there's sort of that tradition between the navies of the world that you don't let fellow sailors drown. If you can, you rescue them. As they got in close enough to pick them up, the Yankee soldiers in Fortress Monroe opened fire on the Confederate ship that was trying to save the Union sailors out there in the water, and Captain Buchanan was wounded. So he was out of action on the 9th when the Virginian took on the Monitor, and his first officer, Catesby Jones, was actually in charge of the Virginia in the battle, the famous battle, the first battle of ironclad ships between the Confederate ironclad, the Virginia, and the U.S. ironclad, the Monitor. So after about a six-hour battle, neither ship could do much to either one. Artillery or a shell from one of the guns on the Virginia had exploded right through the pilot house of the Monitor, and it blinded the captain of the Monitor. And now the tide was running out, and they were afraid that the Virginia was going to run aground. Because what you have to remember, all the Confederate ironclads that they built after this battle had a flat bottom, so they could be used in harbors and coastal rivers. The Confederates weren't going to take any of these ships out on the ocean. They were built strictly for defense for the harbors and coastal rivers. Well, they had built the Virginia over the hull of the old USS Merrimack. So the Merrimack was an ocean-going ship, so it had a deep keel, you know, like a kind of like a V coming down underneath it there, because it was going to be out on the high seas, and you need that for stability to put ballast in there and keep a ship from tipping over in rough seas. So it couldn't go into shallow water. So they had to come back in. And then two or three other times, the ships would come out, and they would see the Virginia would come out, the Monitor would be there to protect the blockade squadron. They'd fire a few shots, and really nothing much happened until the Federal Army closed in on Norfolk from the land side. And now the Confederates were about to lose their naval base at Norfolk, Virginia, or Gosport Navy Yards there at Norfolk, Virginia. Now, they couldn't take the Virginia up the James River to protect Richmond because the river was much more shallow than Chesapeake Bay was there and Hampton Roads. So finally, what they had to do, the same thing, was pack the Virginia full of gunpowder and set it on fire and blow it up to keep it from falling into the hands of the enemy. So that was the fate of quite a few, as we said, quite a few of the Confederate ironclads. They didn't fall to the Union Navy, but they had to be destroyed to keep the Federal Army from closing in behind them on the land side and taking the ship. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting that, like I said, that was the world's first battle between two ironclad ships, was between the Confederate CSS Virginia and the Union Monitor. And that I thought wasn't the thing, but it was one of the things that got me kicked off of a radio program in Nashville. And thank you, Eddie, for letting me talk. But I called in, and the host, supposedly a conservative, was the biggest Lincoln worshiper that had ever come down the road. And he said, well, if the Confederates had won the war and they had gotten their own country, we couldn't have defeated Hitler in World War II. And I said, well, I don't think that's really right. I said, maybe the U.S. couldn't have. But if we got into a war, I think the new Confederate States of America could have done very well. I said, after all, it was the Confederate States and not the United States that built the first ironclad warship. It was the Confederate States and not the United States that built the first submarine to sink an enemy warship, the Hunley, right there in Charleston. It was the Confederate States and not the United States that first used a hot air balloon for observation. It was on the James River, and it was attached to a barge, and they could tow it up and down the James River wherever they needed it. So I guess you could say the Confederates also had the first aircraft carrier. And I said, and it was the first, and the Confederates also had the first electrically detonated mine to sink an enemy warship. And they sank the, on the Yazoo River, that sank Cairo or the Carondelet. I've forgotten which one it was. But it was a gunboat that was sunk on the Yazoo River by electrically detonated mine. And so I said, and their tactics by Bedford Forrest are studied in military schools all over the world. And furthermore, well we've got a break. We've got to go to a break right now. So, boom, boom. Well,
speaking of that, we've got and one. We'll have to come back after this break. We get Cove Bombardier. I mean, get the bitter ender off, man. saying too much about the Confederacy, too much good about the Confederacy.
Proclaiming liberty across the land. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. USA News, I'm Dave Collins. President Biden officially has a primary challenger.
Self-help author Marianne Williamson made it official. She's running for the 2024 Democratic nomination for president.
I request your donations. I request your volunteerism. I request your help. And I say to you now, again, hear me. It's our turn. Let's do this. Thank you.
About 600 people turned out for her announcement rally in Washington's Union Square. The 70-year-old one-time spiritual advisor to Oprah Winfrey is running a long-shot candidacy, just as she did in 2020 when she didn't qualify for any state's primaries. I'm John Schaefer.
And there may be another challenger, a name very familiar in politics, Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's teasing about a possible presidential bid in 2024. Speaking to a crowd in New Hampshire on Friday, the environmental lawyer said,
I'm thinking about it. That's all I'm saying.
But the first person he had to ask...
I passed the biggest hurdle, which is that my wife has green-lighted it.
Kennedy is the son of the late Senator Robert F. Kennedy and the nephew of the late President John F. Kennedy. He joins a short list of Democrats eyeing a potential challenge to President Biden's re-election bid. Former President Trump delivering the keynote speech as the Conservative Political Action Conference comes to a close this evening. Nikki Haley is the only other major Republican candidate to speak there. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Trump's closest competitor in public opinion polls, skipped the four-day event. Winter storms across parts of the country are to blame for flight delays and cancellations. According to FlightAware, more than 700 flights canceled, over 1,800 delayed today due to strong winds and heavy snow. In Boston, more than 100 flights scratched as of noon today. This is USA News.
Non-attorney spokesperson, ad sponsored by Open Jar Concepts. Attention veterans and active duty military. If you were issued earplugs between 2002 and 2016 and were diagnosed with hearing loss or ringing in the ears, you may be entitled to compensation. The manufacturer of these military earplugs recently paid $9.1 million to resolve claims that their earplugs were defective, potentially exposing service members to damaging sound levels that could have resulted in hearing loss or tinnitus. If you or a loved one were issued earplugs and were diagnosed with tinnitus or hearing loss, don't wait. You fought for this country, and our attorneys want to fight for you. Call 800-958-2145 now for a free legal consultation and to see if you may be eligible to file a claim. Time restrictions may apply, and you pay nothing unless there's a recovery in your favor. So call 800-958-2145 now. Again, 800-958-2145. That's 800-958-2145.
I'll tell you one thing that every good soldier knows. The only thing that counts in the end is power. Naked, merciless force!
Yeah, I don't love that sound bite, Blood River Radio people. He's true. You know what? I may not have much education, but there's one thing I know. That in the end, the general, that guerrilla general, he didn't have much education either, but he did know that in the end, after all these eloquent speeches and voting and campaigning and all that stuff, the only thing that matters is raw, merciless force. Anyway, hey, the Bitter Ender has another historical tidbit about an Air Force guy. Go ahead,
Bitter Ender. Yeah, no, go ahead, Eddie. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off there, partner.
Oh, no. I would like to tell the audience about an analogy between the modern day military, and that has to do with the old fuddy-duddies in the old U.S. Navy. Go ahead, Gene.
Yeah, well, we were talking about how could the Naval Department, United States Naval Department, in the 1860s not see the advantage of having an ironclad ship? And they were so traditionalist that they thought these wooden frigates with 20 or 30 guns up and down each side of the ship could destroy anything out there on the water. Well, it didn't matter if you had 20 guns on the port and starboard side or 220 guns. whatever you're firing is just going to bounce off an ironclad ship that has the sides of it set at an angle to deflect either solid shot or exploding shells. And you brought up the analogy of that with a Army Air Corps pilot who said that air power was going to be the new wave of the future, or a new way to wage war in the future, and it could take out these huge battleships. And he actually bombed a United States battleship. Now, it was mothballed. There wasn't a crew on it, so he didn't kill any American sailors. But he actually bombed a battleship and sank it, and that was Billy Mitchell. And there was actually a play and a movie, The Court Martial of Billy Mitchell, and he was court-martialed for using an American warplane and bombing a U.S. ship and sinking it to prove a point that an airplane could take out a ship. And you didn't need another battleship to sink a battleship. One airplane and one bomb that was a direct hit on it would take it out. So that you know, sort of old fuddy-duddy traditionalist idea has gotten us in trouble a lot of times. And, of course, you know, they always say that you're fighting this war with the last war's tactics. And I think that would kind of lead us into our next subject I would like to cover, if you don't mind. A couple of battles that were fought in March by Nathan Bedford Forrest. And I personally believe that one of the reasons that Forrest was such an outstanding commander on the field, he hadn't gone to West Point or VMI or the Citadel or the Tennessee Military Institute. He didn't know what you were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So he looked at a situation and said, well, heck, fire, we're not going out across that open field. We're going to swing around here behind them, or we're going to bluff them, or we're going to fake, let them think we have 1,000 men out there when we only have 500. And I think that's why he was so good. In fact, Confederate General Joseph E. Johnston, after the war, said that they totally misjudged Forrest during the war, the Confederate government did. The federal government, the U.S. government, was much more afraid of Forrest and had a much greater respect for what Forrest could do, because he destroyed so many of their plans that Sherman said, Forrest must be killed or captured if it costs 10,000 lives and bankrupts the treasury. Mm-hmm. And he was the only general in the war that had a bounty placed on his head. Sherman said he would commission anybody in the U.S. Army, give him commission as a major general if they could kill or capture Forrest. Mm-hmm. And none of them did. And he gave a commission to one of the officers that hadn't lost to Forrest as badly as most of the others had. So I guess you could say this officer badly. Beat the point spread. So he beat the point spread, so he got a commission. So anyway, no, but that's why Forrest was so good, because he was such a non-traditionalist, I guess you could say, that he just fought by what made common sense out there on the field. The couple of battles that we'd like to talk about today. Oh, one thing that went on at this Confederate flag ceremony. One of the fellows that was the moderator, he was reading off all the battles that were fought in Tennessee during the war. And he would start with way back at Fort Henry in February of 1862, and then Fort Donelson, then Shiloh, and all down the field. And I was just sitting there and kind of mumbling off under my breath. He'd say, Fort Donelson, I go Forrest. Shiloh, Forrest. This is Murfreesboro, Forrest. This is Forrest. Chickamauga, Forrest. And it was amazing how many of these battles that were fought in Tennessee, Forrest was there on the field. And too many times he gave his commanding officer advice on what he thought they ought to do, and they ignored him, and we lost the battle, of course. But two battles that Forrest fought in Middle Tennessee in March of 1863. The first one was at Thompson Station, which is down south of Franklin, Tennessee. And the Federal Army held Nashville, and they'd gotten it since Fort Donelson fell way back in February of 1862, and had fortified Nashville. In fact, they said that Nashville was the most heavily fortified city on the North American continent, next to Washington, D.C., because they knew that the Confederates were going to constantly keep coming back trying to recapture Nashville. And it was the first state capital that fell to the enemy. It was on the Cumberland River. It had four rail lines that met in Nashville. So it was a very important supply center. So they wanted to hold on to Nashville, of course, and they would send troops out or expeditions out from Nashville into Middle Tennessee, and one was coming south out of Nashville through Franklin and down towards Thompson Station to try to find out exactly where the Confederate lines were after the Battle of Murfreesboro. And the Confederates had fallen back to a line along the Duck River. And Forrest was stationed in Columbia, Tennessee, which was way over on the left, or the western end of that line. And so they wanted to find out exactly where the Confederates were and what they were doing. And Forrest's idea of defending was not to sit there and wait for the Yankees to get to the Confederate position. He went out and met them, so they never got close. So at Thompson Station on March the 4th, the Confederate cavalry under General Earl Van Dorn, and Forrest was one of his brigade commanders, ran into the Federals at a little place called Thompson Station, where there was an actual station on the railroad line there. And while Van Dorn and the Confederates attacked up the Franklin Pike going toward Franklin, Forrest, as he always did, swung around behind them and took out their artillery on a hill that had a perfect firing position and actually got in behind them and shut off the road to Franklin. And they captured their artillery and took over 1,200 prisoners from that expedition. Some of them did escape, and they got back up the road about, I'm going to say about 15 miles, to a little town called Brentwood, which is just a suburb of Nashville now, but it was a separate entity also on the railroad. Had a stockade there on a big hill to protect the depot and the railroad supplies that were coming in there. And then another stockade a little bit south of the town of Brentwood on the Harpeth River to protect a railroad bridge across the Harpeth. So Forrest split his command up into two different units and attacked the village of Brentwood and the stockades there from two directions at one time. This is on the 24th of March. And just to show you how good Forrest was and how he figured out these things, he sent out several different detachments before he ever got there to check and make sure where the Federals were, where there was a place where they could cross the streams, to make sure nobody came up behind him. And he even sent a small detachment all the way past Brentwood up the Franklin Pike to the outskirts of Nashville. Now, there was no way this small group was going to be able to capture Nashville. There were a ring of forts all the way around the south side of Nashville, and it's heavily occupied by Union troops. But then when that small group got there, they split up into other small groups and attacked the outposts on about four or five different turnpikes or roads coming into Nashville. And so now the Union commanders in Nashville thought that there must have been 8,000 or 9,000 Confederates out there ready to attack the city. So they kind of hunkered down behind all the forts and earthworks around Nashville. They had no idea about going out and trying to go after Forrest, because they thought Forrest was out there with an entire army ready to attack Nashville. So that bluffed them and kept them inside the city while Forrest took care of the garrison there at Brentwood, captured wagons, supplies, and more prisoners. The prisoners, it was kind of ironic, the prisoners that escaped from Thompson Station back on the 4th of March were rounded up and captured at Brentwood on the 24th of March. So it didn't do them much good, that run up the road to Brentwood. And now something did happen. A Federal cavalry unit, just by chance, coming up the road from Franklin, which is south of Brentwood, Forrest was getting all these captured wagons and ambulances and artillery and supplies headed west, and then was going to circle back down to Columbia. And the Federal cavalry ran into the rear of his column and recaptured some of the wagons that they had taken. Well, Forrest heard all the firing, and he turns around with his escort and heads back to the rear of the column and scatters the Yankee cavalry. So they recaptured wagons and got them, most of them, back. And one of the funny things that happened, when they sent a detachment down south of Brentwood to take out that stockade or old fort there at the railroad bridge, we will tell you exactly what happened, give you a few chuckles on that after the break.
This is great. I'm loving every second of it. Be right back, folks.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpicTimes.com. this is Matt from Blood River Radio. Blood River Radio is your voice to save our land, our people, and our future. We propose Christian solutions to an anti-Christian assault on our bloodlines. We love what we do, but we cannot do it without your help. The annual operating cost of Blood River Radio is more than even a team of people should bear alone. With your donation, we can take the fight to our enemies and hold our own people accountable for their treachery against us. Please go to our website, www.bloodriverradio.com, and find a way to help us that is suitable for you. We are thankful for any cash, check, or money orders we get. We also appreciate your correspondence or letters of encouragement. Once again, please help, and thank you for joining the fight.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
Tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
I kept waiting on somebody to give us power here at Blood River Radio, but we decided just to take the power. That's how we got it. Ain't it right, Bitter Ender?
Something that Nancy brought up during our break. We have some great conversations on the break, and some of them we could actually play on the radio, and you know, yeah. Wouldn't have to clean it up too much. No, but seriously, she did. And you know, everything you hear in Forrest in the lamestream media today, or the so-called historians, they slam him about being such a terrible, horrible racist. You know, like he just chewed off the heads of black people every morning for breakfast, or something like that. But what actually happened when the war came along, he offered his slaves a chance to earn their freedom. And he said, if you serve faithfully during the course of the war, I will sign your papers to give you freedom at the end of the war, regardless of the outcome. So if the South won and slavery was still in place at the end of the war, his slaves would be free. And he used them as teamsters to drive the ordnance wagons, to haul the ammunition, the forage wagons, had food for the horses. And you're talking about a cavalry unit. That is very, very important to feed the horses. And then the commissary wagons to feed the men. He had blacksmiths or farriers, harness makers. They were cooks, nurses. And there were 45 of them that went with him during the war. And I've heard people say, well, yeah, but he, you know, they were held behind the Confederate lines. They couldn't do anything. And I said, well, you don't know much about Forrest. He spent about as much time behind Union lines on raids as he did behind Confederate lines. And they could walk from here down to the end of the block, and they would be in Union lines, and they were gone. None of them deserted. Then about the second or third time he was wounded, he called them all together. And he said, boys, I don't think I'm going to make it to the end of the war. And he said, but I promised Mrs. Forrest I would grant you your freedom. So you're free to go right now. And he said, we thank you for your service. You've done a great job, but you're free. But we really need your help, and we really appreciate it if you would stick it out with us. And 44 of the 45 stayed with him. And that's a better retention rate than the U.S. or the Confederate Army had. And he said at the end of the war, somebody was asking him about that. And his quote was, there were no better Confederates anywhere in the Army than those men that stayed with me throughout the war. And not only that, but in his escort company. And we talked about his escort company being the shock troops in Forrest Cavalry. And most generals had an escort company, but they just rode around in fancy uniforms. And, you know, they were son-in-laws or, you know, nephew or something like that. Weren't really combat troops, but Forrest's escort was his combat troops. It'd be sort of like the Navy SEALs or the Special Ops or Green Beret or Marine Recon today. And when the battle was in you know, up or down could go either way. He threw his escort company in there to tip the scales in their favor. And there were three at one time, and then I think it wound up about five total during the war that were blacks in his escort company. So they were actually the best of the best. And Forrest Cavalry was probably the best, and then the best of the best was his escort company. And I've seen a picture of a reunion of his escort company in, I think it was 1905, and five of those men in there, there are about 60 or so in this picture, and five of them are black. So they mm-hmm. served with him during the war. And we had a member, and I think he's passed away since then, Nelson Winbush in the Sons of mm-hmm. Confederate Veterans. He was a principal down in Florida, and a black gentleman, and his grandfather, Napoleon Winbush, was part of Forrest Cavalry, was one of the members of the escort. And I remember Mr. Winbush saying, yeah, well, if he was so terrible, how'd he sleep? Because he had blacks around him all mm-hmm. the time. And if mm-hmm. he was such a terrible person, if they wanted to get him, you know, they were right there. Right in camp with him and right shoulder to shoulder with him in the battle, it would have been easy for any of the blacks to just take him out. So we put that story to rest, although the news media will never report it. We were talking about Forrest raid on Brentwood and capturing the main garrison up on the hill there that protected the railroad depot and the rail lines coming through Brentwood. And then we said there was another small fort down just south of Brentwood on the Harpeth River that protected the railroad trestle there. So he sent a detachment down there to take that out. They wanted to knock out the bridge and take out the railroad. And they offered a chance of surrender to the garrison, and they told, no, we're not surrendering. You'll have to come take it. And they said, well, okay. So, fine. They unlimbered an artillery piece, got the range, got the elevation on the gun, and cranked off one round. And that one shell went zipping right through the walls of this fortification and out the other side. And one of the Confederate soldiers said that when he saw that happen, said in about 2 or 3 seconds, you've never seen as many white flags and handkerchiefs come flying out of that fortification as what they saw there. And so then they finished their job and tore up the track and burned the trestle and took that out to cut out Yankee supply lines coming south out of the city. So anyway, that's our little Confederate history for March, the Confederate Flag Day on March the 6th, and then the first battle of the ironclad ships on March the 9th, and up in Chesapeake Bay and Hampton Roads right outside of the city of Norfolk, and then Forrest's two actions in Middle Tennessee at Thompson Station and at Brentwood, all of that taking place in the month of March. And I'm sure there were a lot of other engagements as well. But when we go to 5 or 6 hours, Eddie, we'll get them all covered in a day for everybody.
We sure will. You know, Nancy said she thinks we need to go to 6 hours. So,
oh, my goodness, I will strangle you. You know, Gene, I was going to bring up some other subject you can elaborate on, which I thought was quite interesting. I think it was John Morton was his young artillery.
Yes.
Fallow young man, very young
yes.
man. I think there was some question whether he would be too young. At any rate, they would bury the bull pups, which were actually the limbered small artillery that they would use. They would bury them and go back and retrieve them, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah. Oh, they did. They had all kind of tactics. It was just, you know, a whole century ahead of their times. And mm-hmm. you had also mentioned during the break there at Johnsonville. Now, that mm-hmm. was in November of 64. And the Yankee military governor of Tennessee, Andrew Johnson, had built a supply depot on the Tennessee River and very conceitedly named it after himself, Johnsonville. And it had a port there and railroad lines to run to Nashville and then sending supplies on down. They couldn't go down the Tennessee River because of Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and they couldn't get boats over the shoals back in those days. Of course, Wheeler Dam took care of that, but they didn't have the dam back then to raise the river or the locks. And so they built that port there and then ran the supplies by rail to Nashville and then down the railroads into Georgia for Sherman. So Forrest lined his artillery up two areas there. Part of them were up on a high bluff, Pilot's Knob, over on the west side of the river. And they would fire down into the Yankee gunboats and the barges and the warehouses and everything on the river. And the reason he put them there was because the Union gunboats couldn't elevate their guns up enough to fire up and at them, the Confederates up on the bluff. Then the rest of his guns he put down right on the water's edge, right below the fort that was protecting Johnsonville. And they couldn't depress the guns enough to fire down on the Confederates that were shooting straight across the river and hitting all the barges and gunboats and steamboats that were tied up at the wharf there. So a lot of the critics of Forrest say that, you know, he couldn't be a great commander because all he was a cavalry raider. No, he knew cavalry. He knew how to use artillery. And several times, especially after Hood's disaster at Nashville, he knew how to use infantry to cover the retreat of Hood's army from Nashville all the way back down across the Tennessee River and into Alabama. So he understood tactics and weapons and how to use the combined arms of cavalry, infantry, and artillery to his advantage. That in just about every battle he fought, he was outnumbered. But
well, he
knew
could make
how
them
to
into sailors too, couldn't he?
Well, yeah, you brought that up before. The attack on Johnsonville, he was all the way up into Kentucky at Fort Hyman on the Tennessee River. Mm-hmm. And they captured two gunboats, Union gunboats, by firing artillery at him and forced him into the shore. And then his dismounted men, in fact, one man stripped down his boots and his jacket and everything. Now, this is November, and he put a rope in his teeth and swam across the Tennessee River to tie it onto this gunboat and pull it back across the river. That was a cold swim, I'll tell you what. And they got some of their men on board, and they were going down the Tennessee River or going upstream, going south on the compass, but going upstream to Johnsonville. And so his cavalry was now dubbed the Forrest Navy, and they had two of these captured gunboats. And he told them, now, don't get out ahead of the cavalry. You stay with us in case we run into anything. And so they were hollering and laughing at their buddies that were on horseback, that they were slugging their way out through the swamps and the mud and all this. And they were on these boats, and they were laughing at them, having such a hard time over there trying to get through all this backwater and everything. And they got too confident, and they came around a bend, and they ran into two Federal real gunboats that opened fire on them. And they had to run them ashore and set them on fire and jump off. So, yeah, but Forrest did have his own Navy, too. So yeah.
He was amazing. Quite,
yeah, it is. The things that they came up with.
Oh, and the bridges that they used to build that they would cross, that was really scary. Like they would take a burned bridge and they would use grapevines and different things, and next thing you know, they'd go ahead and cross it. You just unbelievable things they would do.
Well, yeah, they'd made a suspension bridge out of it. So I'm sure that's where they got the idea for the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. Now, they won't tell they won't tell you that, of course. They won't give credit to a Confederate for the Golden Gate Bridge. But anyway, but yeah, that was the principle, that some of those, they were talking about some of those grapevines over in West Tennessee were so thick and so big that they could use them and take planks, strip planks off the cotton gins or some of the farm buildings around there and lay them on those grapevines to get across. Now, I'm sure they didn't have a whole lot of people on there at one time, and I wouldn't want to have been the first person to go across there. But I tell you who would have been the first person to go across there. That would have been Forrest. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't order an enlisted man to do something that he wouldn't do himself. So he probably rode his horse or dismounted and led his horse across there to make sure it was going to hold up, and then the rest of them would come across there. But I know that happened at Fort Donelson when they escaped from Fort Donelson that night. They got out past Dover, and they got to that Lick Creek, and the column stopped. And he rode up to the front of the column and said, well, why'd you stop? And said, well, sir, the creek's frozen. We don't know how deep it is. He said, well, we'll find out. He put the spurs to his horse and jumped his horse off the bank and hit the ice and broke the ice, and the water only came up to the saddle skirts. So, but once again, he wasn't going to ask an enlisted man to do something that he wouldn't do.
That's one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard in my life. We don't have people like that anywhere like that nowadays to his his level. Well, y'all, this is we come to the end, and that's what I have enjoyed. I hope that our our audience has, our Red River Radio family. I hope they've enjoyed this as much as I have. Well, people, like I say, this is the end of the hour, end of the show. We'll be here same time, same place next week on the 11th, and CW will be back. And we'll also continue our degree program. And listen, this is, like I said, this is a bonus question. You might want to, when you write, if you write an essay, include something like, why did Linus Pauling win the 1954 Nobel Prize Award? Or you might want to submit one yourself. Well, good night, everybody.